government regulations, which were created to protect employees, are actually hurting them.
Regulation after regulation.
Until the government understands that they have to create an environment suitable for us to keep growing, we're going to stay in this recession a long time.
The federal government has blocked efforts to expand the ride-sharing.
The owners say the restaurant has succumbed to the crush of government regulations.
We have seen an unprecedented explosion of new regulatory activity.
$1.8 trillion. That's how much business
and bus companies to close.
I think there are outdated regulations that need to be changed. There is red tape that needs to be cut.
The regulations are...
There's a regulation that doesn't make any sense. Why do you keep...
Is this really the best we can do?
This is Free Lunch, the podcast of the Federalist Society's Regulatory Transparency Project. All expressions of opinion on this podcast are those of the speakers.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to an off-hour episode of the Federalist Society Free Lunch Podcast for the Regulatory Transparency Project. Visit the RTP website at regproject.org or regproject.org to subscribe to our newsletter and to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. My name is Devin Westhill. I'm the director of the RTP and the host of the Free Lunch Podcast. This Free Lunch Podcast is brought to you at 10:45 a.m. instead of our typical 12 o'clock noon because we want to discuss with you as soon as possible a recent court decision of the en banc United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit. That case is PHH Corporation versus the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. In short, the D.C. Circuit upheld the CFPB against the separation of powers challenge to its uniquely independent structure. If you've been following the RTP for a while, you may know that our agency enforcement and coercion working group authored a paper in which a chapter is devoted to the PHH case. If you haven't seen that paper, I recommend it to you. It is called Regulating in the Shadows and can be found on the RTP website at regproject.org. Won't go any further into the substance of the PHH case now because we have two experts on this matter joining us as our guests on the Free Lunch Podcast this morning. Our guests, Ambassador C. Boyden Gray and Adam Gustafson, support of petitioner PHH and a friend of the court brief. Ambassador Gray is well known to our listeners, so I'll just say that he became founding partner of Boyden Gray & Associates after a distinguished career in both private practice and public service, having served in the Reagan, George H.W. Bush, and George W. Bush administrations. Adam is a partner at Boyden Gray & Associates, where his practice focuses on constitutional separation of powers, the First Amendment, and regulatory law and policy. Adam previously worked with Cooper & Kirk as a law clerk on the, and was a law clerk on the Ninth and D.C. Circuits and earned degrees at both UVA and Yale Law School. In a moment, I'll get us rolling with some questions for both Adam and Ambassador Gray. Before I do, I remind everyone that the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy initiatives, and therefore all expressions of opinion and Free Lunch Podcasts are those of our future speakers. Both of our guests have also agreed to answer questions after their remarks, so please be prepared with any questions that you might have prior to our Q&A period. Adam, Ambassador Gray, I'm very happy to have you both join us on this Free Lunch Podcast call this morning. Thank you. To get us started, my first question is posed to Ambassador Gray. Ambassador, I think the most important question here to set the stage is what is this case about? What is the PHH case about, and what's its background?
The case is really about the limits, or lack thereof, to the administrative state in terms of its oversight by the three branches of government, and the contours, the edge of the envelope, has been pushed on this issue of independence for a couple of decades now, and nothing really has been done. But this particular agency crosses so many lines that it simply had to be reviewed in court. And the tension and the issue is what are really the limits of a government bureaucracy. The agency arises as a result of the economic meltdown in 2008 and the aftermath, which was the Dodd-Frank law, which many have heard. The criticism doesn't really respond, doesn't really address the causes of the meltdown, skirts it, but gave opportunity to putting a lot of projects into legislation and call it reform. And one of the pet projects was Senator Warren's project to get a totally independent consumer agency to take over all of the laws related to consumer issues, consumer finance, consumer debt, such as the FTC, for example, to take over all of these, I think 18 statutes and six agencies, and take them into its own grasp, totally independent of any oversight by the president, the Congress, and even the courts, in part. So it's a very unique situation. No wonder it produced 150 pages of opinion. That is, I think, an indication of how big a case it is. I like to think of it as if you had this case to teach at a law school, you could build an entire administrative law course out of various strands of reasoning that encompass the 150 pages of opinion, including the majority and minority dissents. The precise background is that when the law was passed, the Federalist Society commissioned a white paper to look at the structure of the CFPB, and the white paper came to the conclusion that it was really truly unique structure of unaccountability, and together with the Competitive Enterprise Institute, we were able to find a very sophisticated but small town community banker in Texas to challenge the constitutionality of Dodd-Frank in federal district court. And with O'Melveny and Myers, we, representing the Competitive Enterprise Institute and the Bank of Big Springs, the National Bank of Big Springs, Texas, CEO Jim Purcell, to make a challenge to this agency. We filed in 2012, and if you can believe it, that case is still in district court 6 years later. That's another indication of how difficult a case it is that it would still be in district court. It's gone up on standing grounds to the Court of Appeals, back down again. And one of the reasons for the delay is that in the interim, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, CFPB, sued a lender, mortgage lender named PHH Corporation, claiming certain violations. I won't go into the law itself. That can come later if you're interested in knowing the administrative aspects of this, but resulted in a substantial fine to PHH, which then appealed internally and got stuck with a fine 10 times as much, which they then appealed to the Court of Appeals and raised, in part at our suggestion, raised not only the administrative law issues, but also the constitutional issues in the oral argument and in the briefs before the D.C. Circuit. The D.C. Circuit ruled, in an opinion by Judge Kavanaugh, ruled the CFPB to be unconstitutional because of the insulation of the director from any presidential control. Adam will go into the details of his rulings on this. He also filed a dissent from the on-bank decision, which overruled him when the case was then taken on appeal by the CFPB from that ruling. And so that's where the case stands now. The Court of Appeals has ruled on bank that the agency is fully constitutional, but they've left standing without reversing the ruling of the Court of Appeals panel on the administrative issues, which at the moment are in favor of PHH. The case was remanded for further action, but there's nothing that the agency can do on remand until the constitutional challenges are cleared up. So that is why the D.C. Circuit felt compelled to address the constitutional issues, coming out, of course, negatively to the PHH litigants. We, on behalf of the Credit Enterprise Institute and the National Bank of Big Springs, Texas, filed an amicus brief supporting PHH on the constitutional issues, and of course, we lost in a sense as well. So that's the posture of the case as it stands now, and I think that maybe it's time for Adam, for you to go into the reasoning of the majority and the on-bank opinion.
Right. Thank you, Ambassador. I think that answers that initial foundational question. What is the case about? What's the background? And goes into another question that I had for you, and I appreciate you being able to cover that in your initial remarks. What is the procedural posture? What is the history of the case? So I think it does make sense to pose to Adam now. I mean, this, as Ambassador Gray mentioned, this was a 250-page opinion with concurrences and dissents and so forth. But Adam, could you summarize for us the majority opinion?
Thanks, Devin. As you mentioned, this is a 250-page collection of opinions. We're not going to be able to do any of them justice, but I'll try to give a flavor for the opinion of the court. Judge Pillard wrote the majority opinion, and she examines the CFPB through the lens of presidential power. The ultimate purpose of our constitutional inquiry, she says, is to determine whether the means of independence, as deployed at the agency in question, impedes the president's ability under Article 2 to take care that the laws be faithfully executed. So with that functional perspective in mind, she walks through each of the indicia of the CFPB's independence. And she finds historical examples of each item and concludes that, quote, nothing about the CFPB stands out to indicate that it is constitutionally defective. After all, there are lots of agencies that enjoy for-cause removal protection, including the FTC, which the court upheld in Humphrey's Executor. Yes, the CFPB's enforcement powers are broad, but Judge Pillard finds the FTC also had broad powers to interpret and enforce the law. Yes, the CFPB also had rulemaking powers, but so do other independent agencies, including today's version of the FTC, different than the one considered in Humphrey's Executor, and the FEC, the Federal Election Commission. Yes, the CFPB gets to draw its own unreviewable budget from the Federal Reserve's coffers, but other independent financial regulators also enjoy freedom from Congress's power of the purse, usually through industry fees. Yes, the CFPB is headed by a single director rather than a multi-member commission, as most independent agencies are. But Judge Pillard finds the independent counsel upheld in Morrison v. Olson was also an individual, albeit an inferior officer. The majority does not consider the effect that all of these different indicia of independence have when they're combined together in one independent agency. But at one point, the court does reject the argument, a more narrow argument, that budgetary independence, that freedom from power of the purse, and for-cause removal protection may be unconstitutional in combination. About that, she says, and I'll quote, "For two unproblematic structural features to become problematic in combination, they would have to affect the same constitutional concern and amplify each other in a constitutionally relevant way. The CFPB's budgetary independence primarily affects Congress, which has the power of the purse. It does not intensify any effect on the president of the removal constraint." So you'll recall that she's examining this question through the lens of presidential power, and therefore, for Judge Pillard and the court, the CFPB's independence from Congress is really irrelevant to the question. Judge Pillard rejects PHH's argument that a novel agency structure is evidence of unconstitutionality. Invoking Morrison and Humphrey's executor, the court says that novelty alone was insufficient to establish a constitutional defect. Again, note that word alone. She quotes the opinion of Chief Justice Roberts in NFIB v. Sebelius, the Obamacare case, to say there's a first time for everything. So that's the court's assessment of the CFPB. There's a first time for everything. This agency may have a unique combination of features, but none of them, the court finds, is so novel or so detrimental to the president's control that it's unconstitutional. And I'll leave that as a summary of the majority.
Well, notwithstanding Judge Pillard's majority opinion there, there were members of the court who thought that the CFPB's unique structure among other independent agencies was at least suspect. I think we might be able to get to the concurrences in the question and answer period, but for now, Adam, there are three separate dissents in this case, as I understand it. Can you walk us through or explain how they differ?
That's right. So Judge Henderson, Judge Kavanaugh, and Judge Randolph each dissented. Judge Henderson, interestingly, was on the original panel, but there she didn't reach the merits because she thought the constitutional avoidance doctrine required avoiding it. But here at the en banc stage, she agrees with the court that the remedy PHH is now requesting in its en banc brief requires a decision on the constitutional issue. So she dives in, but she starts her analysis with a different question than the majority. In Free Enterprise Fund, the Supreme Court said that the lack of historical precedent for an entity is perhaps the most telling indication of a severe constitutional problem. So Judge Henderson looks at this agency asking if it raises a novel combination of independent features. And she finds that no Supreme Court precedent squarely governs the CFPB. As for Humphrey's executor, she says the FTC is not even a distant cousin of the FTC. She cites three principal differences. First, it's freedom from congressional appropriations. That's something the FTC did not enjoy. Second, it's single director, armed with broad authority to punish and define unfair, deceptive, and abusive acts or practices on behalf of one segment of the population. For Judge Henderson, it's significant that this is an agency charged with defending consumers rather than the public at large. And third, she cites the difference that the CFPB lacks the deliberative body of experts that the Supreme Court noted when it was considering the FTC and Humphrey's executor. Likewise, she said the CFPB director is unlike the independent counsel in Morrison, which was an inferior officer and wielded much less power and had far narrower jurisdiction. Turning obliquely to the majority opinion, at least addressing herself to the CFPB's arguments, she criticizes the agency for what she calls a divide and conquer approach to the structural features that make it different from other independent agencies. I like this quote from Judge Henderson's dissent. The apt analogy, she says, is not math, but chemistry. Even if innocuous in isolation, some elements are toxic in combination. One other quote that I think gives a good flavor of the dissent. The CFPB is not the first agency exempt from appropriations. It is not the first agency headed by a single official. It is not the first agency with sweeping rulemaking and enforcement powers over an entire sector of the economy. But the CFPB is the only agency that combines each and every one of these elements with for-cause removal protection and a mission to side with one segment of the population against others. And that, for Judge Henderson, is what distinguishes, pardon me, distinguishes this agency and makes it suspect and novel. Unlike Judge Kavanaugh, Judge Henderson believes that only Congress can fix this constitutional defect. So she thinks that the only proper remedy is to completely invalidate Title 10 of the Dodd-Frank Act, throw out the CFPB, and let Congress start from scratch. The second dissent is by Judge Kavanaugh, who wrote the majority opinion in the panel. He also cites the Free Enterprise Fund case from the Supreme Court, which focuses on, quote, lack of historical precedent as the most telling indication of a severe constitutional problem. I think Judge Kavanaugh might like that quote because it actually is a quotation of the Supreme Court referring to his opinion in dissent in the Free Enterprise Fund case. Judge Kavanaugh also cited the Supreme Court's deep dive into historical practice in Noel Canning and other separation of powers cases. So like Judge Henderson, Judge Kavanaugh is keenly attuned to the novelty of this agency. He finds that the historical practice only highlights the novelty of the CFPB. The parties could identify only three examples of independent agencies headed by a single person, and none of them was like the CFPB. The Social Security Administration and the Office of the Special Counsel were both contested by the executive branch at their origin. So as in Noel Canning, that undermines the historical pedigree of that feature. And as for the Federal Housing Finance Agency, the other independent agency with a single head, Judge Kavanaugh points out that agency is just about as old as the CFPB. So this practice doesn't have deep roots. As in his panel opinion, Judge Kavanaugh emphasizes liberty. Here's a quote that gives, I think, a good flavor of the dissent. In short, Congress structured independent agencies as multi-member agencies for good reason, namely to safeguard individual liberty from the excesses of a single officer's unaccountable decision-making. That's an important difference, I think, from the majority opinion's strictly functionalist approach. Judge Kavanaugh gives less consideration than Judge Henderson to the CFPB's freedom from Congress's power of the purse, but he does note in a footnote that the CFPB's current exemption from ordinary appropriations arguably enhances the concern in this case about the massive power lodged in a single unaccountable director. That's a subtle difference from the majority opinion he wrote in the panel, and suggests that together his colleagues have elevated the importance of the Appropriations Clause issue in this case. Judge Randolph finally wrote the third dissent. He joined Judge Kavanaugh's dissent, but he wrote separately to point out that there's another problem with the CFPB in this case, and that is that the underlying hearing was conducted by an ALJ, an administrative law judge, borrowed from the SEC. And the Supreme Court has recently granted cert in a case called Lucia that raises the question whether such judges are inferior officers who need to be appointed, consistent with the Appointments Clause. So that's another interesting wrinkle in this case.
Well, thanks, Adam. I know that in the paper that I referenced in my initial remarks, Regulating in the Shadows, written by the Agency Enforcement Working Group for the RTP, the use of ALJs is one of the issues that's brought up in that paper. And again, I recommend that to all of our callers who have not yet read it. So I think, Adam, that's a great summary and explanation of the case, the majority opinion, the dissents. Hopefully in the Q&A we can get to the concurrences as well, because I think those are also interesting and important, and a great background in history from Ambassador Gray. But I'd like to turn back to you, Ambassador. Now that we have those elements established here, What in your opinion, is the immediate result of this case for PHH Corporation?
Well, that's, of course, in many ways, the short-term $64,000 question, whether they will appeal or seek cert, more precisely, from this case or not. And there are competing considerations. On the one hand, it would be nice to have cleared up this whole mess in one case, and that's one of the pulls towards seeking cert. On the other hand, it's unclear how long Mulvaney will be at the CFPB. He's acting director. Eventually, I think the White House will be forced to name a permanent director or nominate. And we know where, I think we know where Director Mulvaney stands on this issue. And there's some economy for, or efficiency and speed for a PHH to go back to the agency now and get this whole fine situation, the administrative law situation, the statutory issue that was caused for their case to begin with, to get it cleared up and disposed of. It's not likely to have a final Supreme Court resolution. If it does get to the Supreme Court, we're not likely to see a final decision until 2020 at the earliest. I think it could even be later than that. And maybe PHH doesn't want to wait that long to clear its books for this fine difficulty with the administrative issues before it. So I don't know what's going to happen. I just don't know what's going to happen. And I don't think it's possible that Mulvaney could somehow try to seek cert, but he's in a sense on the winning side as far as his own agency is concerned. He's not going to be questioning the Court of Appeals ruling on the administrative issues. So I just don't know what's going to happen. It's possible that our own case, now still in district court, could move rapidly with the on-bank Court of Appeals having decided all of our issues, move it up to the Court of Appeals, and then we could perhaps seek cert if PHH didn't, or perhaps intervene in their case if they did. But I think on balance, one way or the other, we're going to get a constitutional ruling out of the Supreme Court sooner or later. Unfortunately, it's probably going to be later rather than sooner. It's not going to be in the next year. So people are going to have to wait. But it's a big, big case, and so waiting perhaps isn't that onerous. One point I'd like to make, which Adam referred to but didn't, I think, go into great detail about it. I just want to take a minute to deal with it, because Congress can always step in and fix this in the interim. Might be able to fix it quicker than the courts could. It is Judge Henderson's opinion that the courts can't do this. The court can't simply sever the question of dismissal, independence of the director. I can't simply do that and rewrite the statute in that fashion because of other considerations Congress had when they passed the legislation. Would they have given up their own power of the purse if they knew the president was going to have the kind of power that the president himself was going to have the kind of power that the Kavanaugh opinion would result in if it became a majority view. And so she says it really means just zeroing out the agency altogether and asking Congress to start over. She points out, citing an earlier Supreme Court case, something which is quite obvious, that one branch's handicap is another's strength, and vice versa. And Congress probably, if it's giving all this power to the president, they might not have given up their power of the purse. So Congress has got to work through this. And that is something that could happen quicker, could. I don't think it will, given the dysfunction in Congress that we see today in so many matters. But it could get resolved quicker than the Supreme Court could resolve it. And even if the Supreme Court does resolve it, it may mean going back to Congress anyway. So I just wanted to point that out. And again, to answer your short-term question, what is PHH going to do? Nobody knows. And I guess they have 90 days from the mandate in this Court of Appeals on bank decision to decide. And the mandate hasn't been issued yet. And Adam, I don't know, you clerk there, I don't know how long it takes to issue mandates. I don't suspect the Court of Appeals may be in any hurry to get the mandate out, because it only accelerates the ultimate disposition in the Supreme Court.
They've stayed the mandate using their form order on that matter. So the parties will have the full time they need to decide whether to petition for cert before the mandate issues.
Well, I think that wraps us up very well. We've been on the call now for 30 minutes. I want to give the audience an opportunity to ask questions as well. I do want to point out that there is a different calculus now for PHH as Ambassador Gray, you mentioned. The CFPB Acting Director Mulvaney has expressed concerns about the scope and power of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, both constitutionally as a matter of public policy and other ways. So it will be interesting to know what PHH does. And of course, the calculus has changed also, given the composition of the Supreme Court. Maybe we'll go into a little greater detail when we get into questions. But right now, I think we ought to go to questions. In a moment, everyone on the call is going to hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter star and then pound on your telephone keypad. I'll open the floor now. Okay. Floor mode is on, and when we get to your request, you'll hear a prompt, and then you can ask your question. Our speakers will answer each of the questions that we receive in the order in which they're received. Again, to ask a question, just enter star and then pound on your telephone keypad, and we'll get to you in turn. As we await the questions get queued up, we have a few already. I'd like to make an announcement since I have everyone's ear. This is a final reminder that on Thursday of this week, February 8th at 12 o'clock noon, we will hold a free lunch podcast with Naomi Rao, the current administrator of the Office of Information Regulatory Affairs. Administrator Rao will reflect on the performance of regulatory agencies over the past year and give her thoughts on what we might expect going forward. Again, final reminder that free lunch podcast call with Naomi Rao is on Thursday of this week, February 8th at 12 o'clock noon. Please mark your calendars. Okay, again, to ask a question, please enter star and then pound on your telephone keypad. We'll go to our first question now.
Well, good morning. This is Ken Cuccinelli. I've enjoyed the very thorough discussion, and I do have a question for you. I've heard you talk about the court's opinion that the unique element of the case is the combination of different factors that have considered in singularly in other cases. But I'm wondering, did the court lay out a roadmap for what it would take to actually achieve unconstitutionality? Maybe achieve isn't the right word there, but for such a conclusion. If you said that, I didn't catch it. I only caught the sort of historical look back to other cases. And just as one person, Boyden, I know you've been in this for a long time. I really appreciate you and others being in there trying to protect the Constitution from the government, which, of course, is a significant challenge. And I think the CFPB presents a very significant threat. So I'm curious if any of you think that the court laid out just what it would take to reach for it to have decided unconstitutionality. Thank you.
That's a good question. Just to be clear, while Judge Henderson, in her dissent, does an admirable job of of considering how all of these different features of the CFPB's independence interact with one another, that kind of calculus is, to my eye, not so clearly present in the majority opinion. The majority opinion only considers how the bear removal protection interacts with the freedom from the power of the purse, not considering the other elements of the case, including the single director versus a multi-member commission, et cetera. So I think you raise an excellent question. What would be the agency that would raise a constitutional problem? And the answer may be that as the majority interprets Humphrey's executor, and as the majority understands its obligation with regard to Supreme Court precedent, it really doesn't feel the liberty to find a separation of powers conflict in an independent agency. At least I don't see a clear indication of what that hypothetical agency would look like.
Yeah, if I can jump in, they go, Ken, they go to quite extreme lengths, I think, extreme, pushing the envelope, certainly, to see nothing wrong here and anticipate some of the issues that that might create something that would be unconstitutional, sort of anticipate those as well and knock those down. And so there really isn't any sense that they would see anything as going too far. But it is true that they, looking at the historical context, which is relevant as a constitutional matter for longstanding practices and longstanding norms, they do emphasize that this fits squarely into what has been a long-term paradigm of independence for financial regulatory agencies, that financial agencies, whether it's the Fed or FDIC or whatever, that they have SEC, that they have been independent of White House control or White House influence for a long, long, long time. And of course, what Kavanaugh points out is that, well, not with one-headed director, always with multi-headed commissions. And so that's where there's a square sort of confrontation between the majority and the dissent, and that's unresolved by this case. It may be, however, that they would, and they describe, the majority does, this financial regulation. I find this a little difficult to choke down, but they describe the functions of this agency and the Fed and the FDIC and the SEC as not core functions of the executive branch, which is like saying the economy is not a core function of the presidency, and that I find really hard to believe. And so therein may lie the way out of this is to either argue the next time around that the economy is a core function of the, I mean, gee whiz, what was the fight over the internal market all about to begin with? Why did we have a constitutional convention? It was because the prior regime of patchwork states with no central market. Internal market was hobbling the economy. That was central to the whole point of the Constitution. So that may be the way we find our way out of this, is to say that these are core functions, and in some other case it might involve the Secretary of State or the Secretary of Defense, which they do acknowledge as a core function of the presidency. Similar aggregation of power.
If I could ask one follow up, I think that's a spectacular historical point. And when I see an outcome like this, and your response to my question doesn't surprise me in light of what information I do know. It seems, I hate to use the word because it gets kind of overused in the public discussions, it seems like an extreme position to have all these combination of factors and yet not have a constitutional problem with it. Is this explainable by the makeup, the ideological makeup of the court? And I know I'm asking kind of a political question, but this court got stacked in the last couple of years. And so it seems like a legitimate question to wonder about.
Well, Adam, you clerk there. You have a better viewpoint.
Well, it's certainly true that the makeup of that court has changed. One of the noteworthy details about the first page of the opinion is it notes that Judge Brown, although she participated in the en banc hearing, retired before the opinion was issued. And this is a 7-3 split in favor of the CFPB. That's something that we would not have seen in an earlier day on the D.C. Circuit. So I think that elections have consequences, and we're seeing that now. You ask about the extreme nature of looking at each of these indicia of independence in isolation. I'm reminded of another Judge Pillard opinion on the unrelated question of whether police had probable cause to make some arrests. That was just decided by the Supreme Court in October. And in the D.C. Circuit's opinion, the court considered each incriminating fact in isolation. And Judge Pillard held that each fact was not sufficient standing alone to create probable cause. Now, this is a totally different area of the law, but I was interested to see that Judge Henderson, in her opinion, used the phrase divide and conquer analysis, which comes straight out of that Supreme Court opinion. So I think there's a suggestion there from Judge Henderson, at least, that the same sort of problem is going on, that judges who who have a result that they want to reach are using a sort of siloed and individualistic approach to the relevant evidence. And so that may be relevant to the Supreme Court if it does go up.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Ken. Thank you, Ken, for joining the call today, and thank you for your questions. We're going to go on to our next question now. Before we do, I'll make another call for anyone with questions. If you have a question, please enter star and then pound on your telephone keypad. Caller, when you hear the prompt, you can ask your question.
Hi. Richard Epstein has been complaining for years now that a basic problem of the whole regulatory scheme is that one agency gets to be the creator of the regulations, the enforcer of the regulations, and the judge of the regulations, and that there's no Article 3A which creates a unified legislative branch, executive branch, and judicial branch, and the fact that that it's all vested in an executive department is should be highly unconstitutional. Do you care to? I mean, go ahead and reply to that.
Well, let me. I'll take a. That of course is, the separation of powers issue here, and it's come up.
Yes.
It's come up in different guises, of course. Delegation doctrine, had a short life. Its life of power was short. Its influence has cast a long shadow. But it was only two cases back in 1937 where it really resulted in a wholesale wipeout of a statutory scheme. But that has been the problem: is aggregation of all of these functions in one agency, the headless, so-called headless fourth branch. And it's not a new problem, but it is really, really posed in a most stark way by the creation of this agency, which combines elements from all three branches being cut out of the action, so to speak, in terms of their ability to oversee. And it's like all three branches are collapsed into one in the form of this director, which Kavanaugh says in one of his opinions, or two of his opinions, he's more powerful than the President of the United States on a whole range of economic matters.
I think both dissenters quote Madison's famous quote that the accumulation of all powers, legislative, executive, and judiciary, in the same hands may justly be pronounced the very definition of tyranny. And it's with that in mind that Judge Kavanaugh focuses on the effect that such an agency has on liberty. The reason we have the separation of powers, says Judge Kavanaugh, is to defend against tyranny and protect liberty. And I think when he says that, he's writing as a former Justice Kennedy clerk, speaking a language that will resonate with Justice Kennedy and with the court.
Is there anything the president could do about this agency at this point?
Well, the president has installed Mick Mulvaney as an acting director, which has certainly, I think, changed the tenor of the agency in the short term. At some point, the president will presumably nominate a director to replace Richard Cordray permanently, or at least for the term. So that's, I think, the first step. Boyden, do you have other thoughts about what the president can do?
Well, the president could, I suppose, really, really go out on a limb and have Mulvaney make major cuts in the functions of the agency. But I don't think he can go so far as to eliminate it under, the Take Care Clause. The agency does exist, and I think the best thing the president could do, or Mulvaney could do, is to help get this thing in a posture to be resolved as soon as possible by the Supreme Court.
I agree with that. I would just add that acting Director Mulvaney raised some eyebrows when he submitted a quarterly budget request to the Fed for $0. Now, I don't think we ought to read too much into that, because it was explained that they've got plenty of cash in their account and so don't need any more. But if the president and the acting director were intent on undermining the CFPB in the short term, they could grind the wheels to a halt by simply declining to request further monies from the Fed. That would be a drastic solution.
Well, that request certainly is unprecedented. Adam, and thank you for bringing that up, and thank you, caller, for your question. Another thing, and this goes to the caller's point, I think, and I would just point all of our listeners to an op-ed recently penned a couple weeks ago by Acting Director Mulvaney in the Wall Street Journal, entitled "The CFPB Has Pushed Its Last Envelope." This harkens back to something Ambassador Gray mentioned earlier in his remarks, but I think that shows perhaps where the president's priorities are on this and what he plans to do with this agency. Ambassador Gray and Adam, we have about 10 minutes remaining on our call. I think we'd better halt questions now. I know, Ambassador Gray, you have a hard stop. I'd like to ask if either of you or both have any final remarks you'd like to share with our callers before we end our call today?
Well, I would like to emphasize that a resolution of this case does not solve every problem that's posed by the metastasis of the administrative state, because what it's dealing with is an attempted expansion and getting this thing put back into its place doesn't reform the existing existing landscape. It just forestalls a major step in the wrong direction. You wonder whether any of the political branches now have any say about the administrative state. It's the attitude which I think Judge Henderson adverts to uses the example in the beginning of her dissent. The independence of this agency led Cordray, and some of the listeners may have heard this, certainly, Devin, you know about it, and Adam does. The agency spent $200-something million on the renovation of its headquarters, quite a big sum of money. And Cordray, even though he's not answerable to Congress on the budget, did feel that he should testify when asked. So he testified, and the relevant subcommittee chairman of the Finance Committee asked him, well, who is in charge of this rather lavish renovation? And his answer was, what does it matter to you? And in terms of insolence, I mean, I was insolent to my parents on a number of occasions. The more insolent I got, the bigger the punishment, and the less I engaged in it. But I don't think I know of anything as insolent as that response from an agency head to Congress, which is his creator. And that, I think, typifies why this case, or captures why this case, is so very, very important. If this can't be corrected, then the real reforms that must follow will never get off the ground.
That's the Ambassador. Right. Adam, do you have any final remarks?
Thank you, Devin. I would just add that although we don't know what is going to happen with PHH, whether PHH will petition for cert or not, I agree with what Boyden said earlier, that whether in this case or in another, like the State National Bank case in the district court now, this issue is very likely to get before the Supreme Court at some point. As the dissenters point out in this case, this is a novel agency structure, and it raises concerns that should resonate with concerns that the Supreme Court has voiced about the growth of the administrative state. In the Free Enterprise Fund case, the last big separation of powers case from the Supreme Court, the court pointed out that the president's power to execute the laws includes, as a general matter, the authority to remove those who assist him in carrying out his duties. Without such power, the president could not be held fully accountable for discharging his own responsibilities. The buck would stop somewhere else. Such diffusion of authority would greatly diminish the intended and necessary responsibility of the chief magistrate himself. That's the Supreme Court in a case that they noted explicitly had not asked them to reconsider Humphrey's executor. But there's language in that opinion that suggests that as the administrative state grows, concern about the effect of unchecked agency power has an even greater impact. The court said that granting an agency executive power without executive oversight subverts the president's ability to ensure that the laws are faithfully executed. So I agree with Boyden that when this issue does find its way into a cert petition, I think it presents the kind of case that will be of particular interest to this court.
I have one, Devin, if you don't mind, because there are a couple of minutes. I have one little irony to mention, which is I was reading this opinion, or these opinions, sort of grabbed me. As I said at the outset, and as this discussion makes clear, it's the raw independence of this agency from any kind of accountability to the established constitutional government. It's the raw independence of that which leads to these dissents, and in Kavanaugh's case, the remedy, which would be to substitute a multi-headed, removable, possibly head in place of a single director. But one of the ironies is that, and this is never really quite explained by the majority, if independence is what they want, that's what they've got with most of the agencies that the CFPB is now taking over. I mean, the Fed, for example, the FTC, they're both independent agencies, and if the director is made answerable to the president, it converts all of these independent agencies into non-independent agencies at the stroke of that pen. That's sort of an interesting irony, and it's why I don't think Congress would let it happen quite that way. But that's one of the ironies of this case. What is the, put it another way, what's the grounds for making this agency independent when the agencies it is taking over are all independent?
Yeah,
why not just leave them the way they are, independent, and let life go on as before, which life was going on before quite well. It's not clear what this agency was created to correct.
To follow up on something that you said, Ambassador Gray, just so happens I'm in Las Vegas right now, and I have heard about this story of the hearing with former Director Cordray. In fact, the Inspector General's estimate in his report regarding the renovation of the CFPB's headquarters would cost somewhere in the range of $590 per square foot, which is more than the cost to construct the Bellagio Hotel and Casino here in Las Vegas. It's astounding. I think that's something that our callers might be interested in. And in fact, in the report, it was also noted that the cost for that renovation would be more than the cost to construct Trump World Tower in New York City and also the world's tallest building in Dubai. So it's really astounding.
Well, enjoy your stay in Las Vegas.
all business now, Ambassador. With that said, I want to thank both of our speakers for joining us today, Ambassador C. Boyden Gray and Adam Gustafson with Boyden Gray and Associates, and also, as always, our audience, especially for joining us in the Free Lunch Podcast, had a very off hour for us. And a special, again, thanks to Ambassador Gray for joining us day before his birthday. Happy birthday to you, Ambassador Gray, tomorrow. I hope to have all of you join us again this week, Thursday, when we host our next Free Lunch Podcast call with Administrator Naomi Rao. But until then, so long. Goodbye.
On behalf of the Federalist Society's Regulatory Transparency Project, thanks for tuning in to Free Lunch. As always, you can subscribe on iTunes and Google Play to get new episodes of Free Lunch when they're published. Also, visit our website at regproject.org. That's regproject.org. There, we regularly upload content in addition to our podcasts, such as short videos and papers, and you can join the discussion by sharing your story of how regulation has personally affected you. Until next time, remember, there's no such thing as a free lunch.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.